The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 212 for Monday, July 27th, 2009. Greetings, folks, and welcome back to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire. And that is John Braun.
Last I checked in Fairfield, Connecticut. You know, Pete and I were, Dave, we were on vacation. You know, Pete and I, we tried to pull something together, but honestly, he didn't know which button to press on the, on your board. And it's just, so we just decided to all just take a little rest. And actually, Pete, he's off where he's in
Pilot
Spain.
Pete is in Spain, I believe, from his Twitter stream. I believe everything I read on Twitter, by the way.
It's like the internet. It's all true.
It's all true.
But Pete's doing sangria and paella, and or at least I asked him to, so I hope he will.
Cool. Yeah, it took a week off. We were up at Lake Winnipesaukee, which is only really about an hour and a quarter from the house here, but spent a nice week on the lake. And, you know, so they have satellite internet out there on the lake, John. I've talked about this before. And this time I brought the MiFi up. And man, my father-in-law was totally blown away because satellite has like the speeds were about the same between the satellite internet and the MiFi, but it's the latency on that satellite that'll kill you. It's like 2,000 millisecond ping times. That's 2 seconds.
No, it's a satellite. It's far
of course.
Away. So,
yeah.
Where is this again? What state?
In New Hampshire.
It is in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Okay, but probably, but apparently they have 3G coverage. From what you're telling me,
Verizon does. There was no 3G coverage for AT&T, but Verizon did for the MiFi. Oh, and, right. You know, so the speeds were comparable to the satellite, you know, a meg down, somewhere between half and a full meg up, which is fine, you know. But it was, you know, the 100 millisecond latency on the MiFi compared to the, you know, two seconds. it was, you know,
you might as well just not even bother.
Well, what I did, though, was I because the MiFi only served 5 devices on its own, right? And they've got one house, and then they bought the house next door, and so I mentioned it last year, we ran a cable between the two properties, and so we've got wireless routers in either place that share the satellite. So I, of course, using my favorite DD-WRT firmware, I put it in wireless repeater mode, so it grabbed the signal from the MiFi and then shared that amongst all of the machines, both at their house and then at the Point house. So they were very sad when I took the MiFi away. The problem is they were using more bandwidth than would be economical with the MiFi. But I get the feeling that my father-in-law may not care. And even if his bandwidth bills are upwards of $500 or $600 a month for the couple of months that he's there in the summer, he may just go for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't there, a 5 gig? Do they have a monthly cap?
They've got a 5 gig cap on the $60 a month plan with the MiFi.
Okay. Wow. I remembered that.
My guess is he would use that in about 10 to 15 days. Yeah. Yeah. So, but anyway, it was a fun little experiment. And
now something we should talk about at some point in the future. Little tangent. Sorry, folks. It happens. But I've seen some stuff online about discrepancies between the bandwidth that people were under the impression they were consuming and the bandwidth reported by the provider.
Right.
Where you say, well, my router says, and you can use various utilities to measure this.
Well, the MiFi itself measures it, but it says right in the web interface, don't trust these numbers. You got to log into your Verizon account to truly get the the numbers out of it.
Okay. To my point is that different people or devices or locations measure bandwidth differently. So you may say, I use the gig, and they're like, well, no, you use 10. So cough over the dough, and it's like, well, who's right? And how? Yeah. So something I'd like to get one and just try to flirt with that issue because it sounds like a handy device.
It's awesome. It really, we were blown away. The one issue that we had was that it did keep disconnecting. And I think it was because, you know, we may have been, even though the signal strength said it was, 4 or 5 bars anytime we checked, I get the feeling we were at the edge of the EVDO service range. And sometimes it would just disconnect. There were times where it stayed connected for hours And then other times it would disconnect, you know, five times an hour, which can be a little frustrating. My father-in-law, his business is down in Florida. So he was remote accessing, you know, remote desktop essentially is what he was doing to get in. And of course, when you lose your connection, well, that, you know, it's not like email where it just sort of recovers, or web browsing, and it just recovers with a remote desktop connection. You got to start that whole sucker up again. So,
Course, you know, any meter on a device lies.
Of course.
You know, right. They just change the, let's make it say 5 bars just to make the customers happy.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm kidding, but AT&T, I wish I wasn't.
AT&T talked about this where they basically said that, you know, with their system, the number of bars is not necessarily the strength of the signal, but it's the chance that you have of making a call. that really, I mean, this is what it came out to be. It was like,
so you can play the lottery with this.
Seriously? Yeah. So I got 3 out of 5 chance of making a call. What the heck is that?
Well, those are probably not bad odds.
No, they are.
At least not in Vegas, right? Okay.
That's right. You're better than the house. We have a relatively normal show here, but we've got weeks of stuff stacked up and we won't get to it all. I guarantee you. But we'll start off with, well, we won't start off. We will move into, you know what? Let's talk about our first sponsor for the show, John.
Yes.
Audio Engine at audioengineusa.com makes all sorts of products dealing with, you guessed it, audio. I wanted to talk about the A5 speakers. This is their flagship product. These are bookshelf speakers, a little bit bigger than desktop speakers. If you want desktop speakers, you go for the A2 speakers, which are a little bit smaller, but still pack a decent sound. The A5s are $349 for the pair. These are separate speakers. These are the speakers that John and I both have on the desk that I believe we're using now. They certainly are on my desk. Are they on the one that you're using at the moment, John?
No, mine are in the party room.
Oh,
because that's where they belong.
Yes, that's where they belong. Oh, yeah. Excellent. And you can, they've got standard Mini 8 inputs, so you can hook these up to just about anything, either directly or with an adapter. They come with a whole big set of cables. They also have a USB port on the top, so you can charge your iPod or iPhone while you're listening to music. So, they totally self-contained, self-powered speakers. You need to obviously plug them into a wall, but they have their own amplifiers. And totally balanced to match the enclosures that they're in. 2 speakers in each enclosure, a woofer and a tweeter. They really deliver a warm, full sound. And as John can attest, they fill up his party room very well. One thing that has been added now, we've had Audio Engine as a sponsor for years on this show. And they have now given us the opportunity to share a discount with all of you. Maybe it's because of the Econolips. Maybe it's just because they're nice guys. Maybe it's because they want to be nice to you. Or maybe it's all 3. But if you use the code MGGTEN, that is, I'm missing Pete here for my NATO phonetic alphabet. That's Mike, George, Tango, Echo, November. Yep. You get 10% off. So it's MGG10, but make sure you spell out the word 10, and you get 10% off any order you place there. So $349 comes down to about $315, and they have a 30-day audition where you can download. You can order these speakers and try them out for 30 days. And if you don't like them, you send them back and they'll give you your money back. So that's all at audioengineusa.com. And from there, we will move into Johnny with an iDisk issue. I think I clicked the button. You know, is it going to go? No, it's not going to go. This is splendid. It's coming to get me, John. It knows that I'm back from vacation, and it's coming to get me. I got it right here. I'm going to pull it up again. I closed the file. I'm opening the file. Go, Johnny.
Hey, guys. Great show. Calling with a problem I have with an older PowerBook G4 12-inch that I've not been able to sort out. It's running 10.4.11, and lately, in the last, I don't know, month or two, if I try to shut it down with the iDisk mounted, it hangs, the menu goes away, the screen still shows the background image, but basically it'll stay there forever or until the battery runs down. If I force it to shut down by holding down the power key and restart it and look in the console, There are messages about basically the iDisk is not responding, and I believe that's what's causing it to hang up when it shuts down. If I manually unmount the iDisk and then shut it down, it seems to shut down normally. I've not been able to figure out what to do other than manually unmount the iDisk before I shut it down every time. Unfortunately, sometimes I forget, and it'll start to shut down, and then the screen will go blank just from the power saver, and I think it's shut down, but it's actually not shut down, and it keeps running until the battery's dead, and then when I try to restart it, it won't restart because the battery's dead. It's kind of annoying. If you could shed any light on this, appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, John, you want to take a crack at this one?
I'll open with a couple of things, and then, as we often do, we collaborate on this. So I was going through this question, and I put a little note in my notes saying, is there a process for unmounting volumes? Because that really, I would say, off the cuff, that's the problem here. It's trying to ditch this volume, and it just can't get rid of it, so it just sits there forever and ever trying. It'd be nice if it timed out. So there's a command to do that, and then I'll mention something that I thought of when I was digging a bit deeper during the playback. But there is something that I think you found, Dave, called diskutil unmount /volumes/iDisk, whatever the name of it is.
Well, okay, so let's expand that a bit. So the command line utility is diskutil, diskutil, all one word. Mm-hmm. And then the format of the command to use it to unmount is diskutil space unmount, again, all lowercase, and then slash volumes with a capital V, and then slash I, lowercase I, uppercase D, and then lowercase ISK. On my machine, I have iDisk, and I also have a volume called Dave Hamilton, which is my Mac, my mobile media username. So I have both of them out there, but local copy of my iDisk. I have iDisk syncing turned on. So I think that's why I have /volume/iDisk.
Yes.
I'm guessing for you, John, you only have your mobile me account name, and you do not have a /volume/iDisk. Is that correct?
Yes. The one little thing I want to mention is that when I saw this, I noticed. So yeah, I have Macintosh HD, which is, I use the default there.
Sure.
And then my iDisk name. What I noticed is that, and you probably did too, but if you go into the terminal and you do a directory on this, they have very different permissions and also owners and groups and all of that stuff. My only suggestion is if you're seeing this sort of weird stuff happening,
yep,
you might as well verify and or repair your permissions. It could be that...
Okay,
just speculating, because I look at this and I see that the permissions are kind of unique. I mean, it should get rid of it. I mean, now that I'm looking, I think it's just a world permission. The first, it's a D and then an RWX permission because it's actually a directory.
And so you do not have an entry for IDISK, is that right, John?
Because I do not do a local sync, which is exactly, because I was wondering, I'm like, why are you seeing that? I'm like, were you typing this as a substitute or do you see that? And the thing is, you see that because... You do this. I do not do the sync thing.
That's interesting because in looking at it, all it is a symbolic link. So it's an alias, Unix alias. IDISK in my /volumes folder points to /volumes/Dave Hamilton. Just like Rouge, which is the name of the hard drive on this machine, is just a symbolic link to slash, which is, of course, the local hard drive. So I'm surprised that symlink isn't there. But suffice to say, what I have seen happen in this volumes folder is it can get confused. What can happen is once it mounts the volume, it attaches it here. So if you have, let's say I have my Drobo, right, which I called stuff. OK. And in my volumes folder, I have an entry called stuff. Now, if I had a piece of software that was built to just automatically write to /volumes/stuff/ Dave's files, right? If I unmounted my Drobo and then I ran this program that went to go and write to volume stuff Dave's files, it would write to /volume/stuff/Dave's files on my root hard drive, on my built-in hard drive. If stuff wasn't mounted, it would create a folder called stuff that would no longer be a pointer to the drive to the Drobo, it would be just a folder. And the computer would really have no way of knowing the difference until it went to mount the Drobo. And when it went to mount the Drobo, it might say, okay, I'm going to go attach this and put a entry in volumes for stuff. And it would say, oh, that exists. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make the Drobo attached to /volume/stuff/1. And you can create multiple folders for the same drive, and things can get a little confused. Because of that, I wonder if that's part of what's going on here for Johnny. And what I do in that scenario, and you have to be very careful about this, is eject all the disks I can, eject the iDisk, eject anything except for my root hard drive. And if there's one disk I can't eject, I make note of it. Then I go into /volumes and delete anything that's not related to a currently mounted disk. That may help. You might have, you know, if your iDisk is named Johnny, you might have /volume/Johnny and then /volume/Johnny/1. And that might be part of the issue. I don't know. I kind of like your permissions thing though, John. I think that that's likely more down the, yeah, the avenue.
If it's getting stuck there, this may help it get unstuck. But the other thing I noticed is that, no, I forget the exact, I think you mentioned it, but sometimes when you see a volume getting mounted with its name and like a suffix.
Yep.
I don't know if the Mac does, you know, paren one, paren two, or copy
just
of.
Just a
or,
space, but, space one, space two, yeah. Space three.
Okay.
That's it. Yep.
That's a sign, as I think you hinted, that, yeah, things are starting to fall apart.
Yeah.
It's like,
you know,
why are you adding this? I mean, it's a smart thing to do.
Right.
So it doesn't potentially clobber something that maybe shouldn't be clobbered, but then, right. Yeah, it kind of spirals out of control, and then you're yeah.
Yep. And I've seen this happen with Time Machine stores as well. You know, my Time Machine volume is called Milestones, and on most of my machines, now it's called Milestones-1. I guess that's it. It's a dash. It's not a space. It's a dash right. One. And, you know, eventually I just go in and clean that up. But then you get a repoint, and it gets confusing. So, yeah. Maybe that helps, Johnny. Let us know. Evan is up next. Evan writes, one of my favorite features of iPhone OS 3.0 is notes syncing, but I have a question about it. Every time I create notes on the iPod or iPhone and I go back to sync them to the Mac, I get a prompt whether I want to sync notes or cancel because it changes more than 5% of the data on the computer. I click sync and then it works fine. I'm just wondering if there is any way to make it sync notes automatically without having to be bothered by the pop-up. I remember seeing an option for this somewhere in something's preferences before, but for the life of me, I just can't find that setting anywhere. I've looked in Mobile Me as well as many others. Any help you can give remembering where that setting would be great. Okay, John, we've talked about this on the show before, but you found the answer this time.
Oh, man. Yeah, and it's in a...
It makes sense once you find it.
He was on, well, no, I don't think it does. They should really move this because a lot of prefs in a lot of... Yeah. Apple applications tend to be duplicated or move around as they watch users kind of struggle and flounder and not find it. In this case, you got to go to iSync. Yes, I said iSync. And most people will be like, iSync, what? Do I even use that? Which you may not, but there's a setting in there. If you go to iSync, preferences, then there's a heading, protect your data on this computer, which is a good thing, I think. And then there's a checkbox on a setting called show data change alert when, and then there is a pull down, and the pull down here, or whatever type of list you want to call it, the choices are, and I think it defaults to more than 5%, but the choices are any, which I would not recommend because it's going to be pestering you forever, or you could say more than 5, 25, or 50%. Now, I kind of like this setting because sometimes if you are, you know, mixing different devices or calendars or schedules, you may not want to blow away your entire calendar. So some of these higher threshold settings, like 50%, if you're going to be changing everything in your calendar, you may want to think twice as to whether that's really what you want to do.
Right.
Because I would say more often than not, when that happens, that could lead to you know, major unhappiness.
Yeah. One thing that's worth mentioning is this is a global setting for all of sync services. Yeah. So you don't have the opportunity to set it just for notes. You know, you can't set notes to 50% and calendars to 5%. It is everything gets this same setting. So I, like you, John, I, you know, I think on most of my machines, I bumped it up to 10 or I don't know if you can do 10, but whatever the next notch up from 25. Five is. 25, yeah. And that way, like you said, if something is going to clobber a substantial portion of any one of your data stores, it's going to warn you. But otherwise, you know, if it's 6 or 7%, you know, come on, just go. Yeah. Especially as you build up notes. You know, I had this issue with Yojimbo years ago when I first started using it. It complained on all, and I did not know about this setting at the time. I found it months later, and I think we talked about it here. But, it pestered me for a while. But then it got to the point where, you know, three changes out of 1,000, entries in Yojimbo wasn't enough to, it just got, you know, the data store built up to the point where 5% was no longer, you know, ever being hit.
Oh, I see.
Right. Okay. So that, depending on how you manage your notes, that may also happen. I mean, if you get, you know, if you're changing three notes, well, you know, once you get above, and math is failing me today, but once you get above the 365, right, or so, then that's above 5% and you're good to go. I think that's right. Yeah. Once you get above 60, right, that would do it.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. Jeanette. I'm finding Jeanette. Speak of Yojimbo, here it comes. Okay. I was wondering if you could recommend a couple of apps. First, I am looking for one I can set to record screen activity, something that does not have a time limit and can save the video once I stop it. Second, I was wondering if you know of a good app I can install to activate the eyesight and record while the screensaver is activated, more for monitoring purposes. If there are free apps that can accomplish what I want, I'd be great, but I'm willing to pay a reasonable price as well. Okay. Question number one, screen recording. John, go.
My answer, and I have been using this for ages, and I love these guys. Snaps Pro from Ambrosia. Ambrosia, yep, just rocks. And actually, one of the head cheese there, I think, actually lived near me when I was a wee lad. But they also got a cool parrot. I think they have a parrot cam now for Hector.
Okay.
But they make awesome software. And so Snaps Pro has different, I believe they still have different versions. One that just does pictures and one that does pictures and movies. Or maybe they've just rolled it all up into one. Snaps Pro.
It's all one.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm thinking of
they used to have Snaps and Snaps Pro, I believe. And Pro did video, whereas Snaps did not. But I think now it's all in one. So.
Okay, yep. But they're great. That's a tried and true utility for both pictures and doing movies of what's happening on your screen. And then you have one that you've used, Dave.
Well, used Snaps Pro, and that's the one that I use constantly. But there is something called ScreenFlow, and I have seen demos done with ScreenFlow, and it's cool because you can highlight where the mouse is. There's some additional things, whereas Snaps is built to do a lot of different things, including, image capture. And you can, you know, Snaps is cool because you can do like a static, you know, JPEG or PNG grab, and then you can have it put a little shadow around it and save it in whatever color format you want. ScreenFlow is built primarily for doing exactly what Jeanette wants. Now, Snaps Pro 10 is $69. ScreenFlow is $99. But there are some very cool things that ScreenFlow does, and you can highlight different things and really sort of interact with ScreenFlow while you're creating these. Both of them will allow you to record your audio, so you could walk someone through and then send them the video, and they'll hear your voice as recorded by your Max microphone or whatever microphone you choose, and then also see what you did. But definitely worth checking them out. We'll put links to both in the show notes. The ScreenFlow is from telestream.net. And as you said, John, Snaps Pro is from ambrosiasw.com. So,
yeah. And I use them almost every article that, and I just wrote an article today, but I use them constantly both for, they have a feature that lets you identify a portion of the screen to take a picture. Usually I use this for making an icon, or they identify objects. So if there's a window or something, you just click on that and it does a snapshot and puts it in your pictures folder, in addition to movies and doing the whole screen. But it's really just, I couldn't imagine writing an article that has any graphics without using them, because I always do.
Okay. So I'm going to take a little tangent here, John.
Whoa.
both to instruct you and teach our listeners. So you said for using, for creating an icon, you used Snaps Pro to snap a picture of the app's logo, perhaps. Well, in macOS 10, most apps come with very high resolution versions of their logo as their icon that you see in the Finder. And you can go and grab a copy of that. What you do is you go into the Finder, you do a get info on your on the application, and then you highlight in the upper left-hand corner, you highlight the app's icon. You go to the edit menu and choose copy, or simply do command C. Right. Then you go into preview and you do a new from clipboard, and you will see you have usually four different sizes of the icon. And you can grab any one of these out of there and save it as a PNG or whatever you like to the desktop. That's what we use a lot of times for article images. If we're, you know, if we were going to talk about, you know, say Snaps Pro, we would go and grab their icon that way and do it.
Interesting.
Yep. So I share that with you, John, because it'll help for TMO articles. And I share it with the listeners because there's infinite uses for things like this. So.
I'll try it, because what I did is that I think a lot of our icons are 80 by 80.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did is I went into the Finder,
yep.
went to view options, I think, and said make the icon size 80 by 80. And then
that works.
Just because I wasn't sure. No, but you bring up a good tip.
Well,
I
the good part about doing it this way is you get it as a transparent image, which
that was handy.
Yeah. Now, you know what? We should talk about this here because I'm pretty proud of what we did at TMO. We rolled this out pretty much the day I left for vacation.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Back on the 17th, we changed the homepage of TMO. And but the goal was to go back to having the headlines as the kind of the focus of the homepage. We had gotten into having the news briefs being the default, and it was just getting too cluttered. There was too much data out there. You couldn't find the articles. And so we wanted to move to that. But we wanted to continue to be able to feature more than just one or two articles on the homepage, which was kind of what led us to our previous design. And the idea was to use kind of a la iTunes, where you see at the top in the podcast directory or whatever, you see the kind of those rotating images. Well, the idea was to do that for TMO, but to make it automated so that we didn't have to create new images for every article we wanted to highlight. And so Stephen Swift took that and ran with it and created what you see there. The one thing that we can't do yet is we can't sense whether an image is transparent or not. And it's because Image Magic, which is the library that we're using to do this on the back end, does not yet have that, but it's in a pre-release build. So we're hoping that that we'll get that soon. That's why I point out the transparent part, John, because we'll start being able to do some very cool things with the images. Nice. That once we can sense whether or not they're transparent. But yeah, Stephen then also took it a step further, and you know, you get your list of headlines, but if you want to see the news brief for any given headline, you can just click on it and it sort of slides down and shows you the news brief.
Yeah.
Or you can do it when it hovers, and he's got all these different settings, and he knocked it out of the park with that one. I'm
no,
really
that's
proud
awesome. I liked it. At first I was like, where's all the eye candy?
Right.
And I'm like, you know what? Do I really need the eye candy all the time? Maybe
no.
I want to get high bandwidth and find out what the news is.
Right.
And this layout does it. So
yeah. And if you want the eye candy, you can just set it to show you the news briefs all the time, and it will. You know, it's all still there, but I think it's better off. So kudos to the TMO team for taking the vision and making it happen. Jeff Gamet helped to design the layout of those teaser blocks or news brief blocks or whatever you call them. But
Jeff makes things that look pretty.
He does.
Functional, you know, too.
Yeah, he does. All right. So speaking of cool apps, we have a new sponsor for the show, and that is Cocotec at cocotec.com. And the product that we're talking about from them is Pathfinder. Now, I have heard about Pathfinder for years. People talk about it as, it's a Finder replacement. You know, yeah, the last thing I need is, you know, to replace something I completely rely on all the time. Well, I installed this today for the first time because I wanted to be able to talk intelligently about it. It's pretty darn cool. The idea is, imagine taking the Finder and then integrating it with the coolest features, the most useful UI features from both, say, Safari and iTunes. Now, you can use tabs. So you can have one Finder window that has multiple windows in tabs, right? So you can kind of keep that all together.
Dude, like Safari.
Like Safari, awesome. Right? You can have a bookmarks bar a la Safari. So you can, and it's, of course, totally customizable. So you can click on, you know, you can have your little list of things on the left that you know, you still have. But if you always find yourself going somewhere, you can have a little bookmarks bar at the top and you hit that and boom, it brings you there. It'll also do a double paned view. So you can have two different folders open at once. But there's one thing that really hit me and it's called DropStack. And the idea behind DropStack, you know, when you're in a folder, John, and you say, ooh, I want to copy this file or, you know, this folder that's in here, this subfolder to somewhere else. Well, usually you either have to drag it out to the desktop and then go navigate to where you want it to go and then drag it in or open another Finder window or drag it on top of your hard drive icon. Wait for that to spring load open. And then you're kind of holding the button down and it gets really awkward and all that. Well, they have what's called the drop stack. And what you do is you take what you want and you put it on the drop stack. And the drop stack kind of lives over on the left. And then it sits there and it is a stack. So you could pile five things up there and it stacks them up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then you go to where you want to put it and you re-navigate. And then you drag it off the drop stack. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 in that order. And it, boom, it just pulls them right off and moves them. Doesn't copy. Well, of course, it'll copy if you're doing... if you, you know, between volumes, but if it's all on the same volume, it will just move the file just like you had dragged it in the Finder and really makes that smooth. It, you know, like I said, I installed it today, have not had an opportunity to use it long term, but I plan to continue testing it tomorrow. Also has terminal integration, so you can just get to the right to the terminal. In fact, you can even have a little breakout window with the terminal in the bottom. Pathfinder is available from cocotech.com. You get a 30-day free trial if you like. A new license is $39.95. If you happen to own an older copy that you bought since July 1st of last year, you can upgrade for free. If you bought it before that, it's half price. It's a $20, $19.95 upgrade if you have Pathfinder 4. So this is Pathfinder 5 from Cocotech at cocotech.com.
Nice. I was looking at their page. I see some nice Subversion plugin and some other things there.
Yep. Yep.
Can you toss me a code or something there?
I don't have a code.
No, yet. I know you did.
did I? No, not for this one. No, I don't have a license code for this. I'm just using my 30-day free trial. But we can get review codes if we want to move on with it. I'm sure.
I'm gonna get started.
Yeah,
I like it. Okay, yeah, so cool. Where are we going?
We are going to. We should talk about James. We've had this one kind of in the queue for several weeks, and it's a topic.
And despite what the lawyer said, we're gonna talk about this.
That's right. So James says, I'm currently ripping all of my CDs and DVDs to my Mac using iTunes and Handbrake respectively. I was just curious if you know of any software that would allow me to copy the DVD in its entirety, menus, special features and all, instead of just copying the movie. I'd appreciate any input. Okay. So the idea is you can do this, and there's a couple of utilities, right? First of all, Disk Utility will do it. You can make an image of the DVD in Disk Utility and then burn that image off to another DVD. There's a couple of issues. Number one, if it's protected, then Disk Utility won't do it. You'll have to use a piece of software like Mac the Ripper. And you, of course, need to check with your local ordinances and all that before you embark down this path. If it's protected, you're going to need to use Mac the Ripper to rip it to your machine. What's cool about that is Mac the Ripper will create a folder that will have an audio_TS and a video_TS file that looks just like the DVD. And you can point DVD player to that folder. So you can play the DVD right off your hard drive, or if you save it off to like a Drobo or some network volume or something, you can play right from there and you'll get all those menus. If you want to burn it back to a disc, again, a couple of caveats. If the DVD is dual layer, it will be larger than 4.7 gigabytes, which is the size of a single layer DVD. Most Macs these days will burn dual layer discs, but you have to buy the media. And that media is, I think, about three times the price, maybe more than single layer media. So, you might want to use something like I use DVD 2110. So it's DVD, the number 2ONEX, to take those large video files and shrink them down to fit on a 4.7 gigabyte disk. And when you do that, you can strip out all the, you know, if it's got French and Spanish in there and all you want is English, you can rip those out and make more room for the movie, and it'll compress the movie dynamically to, you know, give it as much quality as it can while still fitting on that 4.7 gigabyte disk. I don't believe Disk Utility will burn a video TS folder back. I think you have to use Toast to do that. That's certainly what I use. And you burn it as a UDF format disk, and it works. So any thoughts on that, John?
One thought is, you kind of tap dance around the whole legality thing.
I did.
Based on what I know, at least in the... no, I didn't, because I want to talk about this. And I'm going to shake my fist at you and the whole industry.
Good.
According to law, at least in the U.S., it is currently, last I checked, Dave, help me out, but it is illegal to duplicate a DVD, because what you are doing is you're violating, and I wish I remembered the law.
DMCA?
Digital Millennium Copyright Act? Yes. Yep. Thank you. We're such a good team. So this law says you are not allowed to circumvent technology meant to protect copyrighted works. I think that's the gist of it, right, Dave?
That is the interpretation that some people have of that law. Yes.
Yes. So, and they actually tried, and there were a bunch of scholars and other smart people that tried to talk to the group coming up with this, saying, can you make an exception for backups, guys? Because people buy a DVD sometimes for dollars or tens or maybe hundreds of dollars if you get a big old collection.
Right.
Why shouldn't you have the right to circumvent the copy protection, which is pretty much on all commercial DVDs with studios, and make a backup like you can with most pieces of software? Well, based on what I saw when they last, tried to run this up the flagpole, it got knocked down. The flag was ripped from the pole, and they said, sorry, no, we can't make that exception for you people. You're a criminal because you want to back up your movie that you, you don't own it. You license it. I right. forget the mindset of these people. And I do mean these people. Take it.
So here's the thing, though. I agree with you. That is how I understand the genesis of the DMCA to have happened. But I don't believe there has been any case where someone who backed up their DVDs has been tried and convicted of any crime. And I don't believe they want to try that, because it will get the whole DMCA yanked if they do it. Because I'm pretty sure that if you push it as far as the Supreme Court, it's going to get there, and they're going to say, well, this law
is
ridiculous.
The thing is, right now, it's pretty much at the nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Right.
Here's a utility that lets you do this. We somehow got the key that lets us decrypt the DVD. Just don't tell anybody.
Right.
But also, don't be too blatant in advertising the fact that you give people the ability to do this. Otherwise, they will come down and they will give you the big smackdown with all their lawyers.
If you make a copy of it and sell it, well, then you deserve to be prosecuted.
Well, you and I, Dave, back in our day,
we never sold anything.
No. That's you and I only liberated things because it was a technical challenge.
Correct.
Not that we were making boatloads of money, because
we weren't. Right.
Basically, our challenge was, and you remember our friends, who can crack this first?
Right.
Dude, if I get you a copy of this, can you crack it and then, you know, put me on the title page? Cool.
Right.
Okay. That's my motivation.
That was the motivation.
And to me, I think, and most people who travel in our circle, someone who sold something like someone who pirated and sold it, they deserve to be taken down. That's breaking
absolutely.
A code that I think should not be broken. That's
I agree.
Just wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
All right.
Back on the track, if we can find it.
How are we doing? Oh, we're doing good time-wise here. All right. You know, we've had this tip in the queue for a while, too, so we're gonna move this out. We talked about deleting pesky files a number of shows ago, John, and Michael wrote in back in the middle of June talking about, he says, sometimes I get the busy file even after reboot. We had suggested, you know, put it in the trash, reboot, come back around, you can empty it, you're good to go. I found that what has worked for me when the reboot fails to let me empty the trash is when the reboot fails, is to empty the trash, restart, then secure delete. That seems to have worked every time I've had this problem. And that's his story, and he's sticking to it. Now, to secure delete, you go to the Finder menu. Yes. And choose secure empty trash. And it will pop up a dialogue that says, are you sure you want to erase the items in the trash permanently using the secure empty trash? Now, my understanding is that this simply deletes it and then overwrites where that file was to ensure that that data is less easily recovered. But apparently, based on Michael's experience, there is it does something a little bit different. And I don't know what that is, but it's worth trying if you have a file that won't go away.
Well, I think you're on the right track. I think I'm wondering if it does a more forceful.
Yeah, that could be.
Delete, because it's like, you know, I'm going to wipe you out anyway. So,
yep.
You know, just, yeah, I don't know. And it's probably doing similar to disutility, where there's like a DOD level delete. I think there are, you can do 1, 7 and 35 rewrites. When you delete a drive at disutility. So this is, I think, a form of that. I'm sure it doesn't do the 35 rewrite thing because that's just crazy. But it at the very least, it scrambles the data, probably using a known pattern so that, as you said, Dave, you can't easily pick this data up, because a lot of times when you delete, you're just marking a directory entry saying, okay, if you need to use this, fine, but it doesn't touch the data at all. So
Right. Well, you know, another thing to mention here is that when you go to the Finder menu, you see empty trash and secure empty trash, and they both have ellipses after them, which means that you're going to get a dialogue. And you pointed this out, John. I found this invaluable. If you're in the UI, I'll restate what you said a couple of months ago. If you're in the UI and you see an option, either a button or a menu item that has three dots, the ellipses after it, it means that you are going to get another display, either a preference pane or, you know, some other dialogue before the option that you've chosen is executed. So if you see empty trash with three dots or secure empty trash, you know that you're going to get some kind of confirmation dialogue. Very handy.
However,
what's that?
I'm sorry. We think alike, because I was going to toss that in, the ellipsis.
Yeah.
And actually, it aggravates me when I see people that are on a budget write software and they don't follow the guidelines, like putting, because to me that warns me, you know, something's coming. This is not the end of the world.
Right.
I'm not going to empty your trash. I'm going to ask you at least one more question.
Right.
When people don't follow that, that's really dangerous. But
it is dangerous.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay. So if you hold down the option key, and the best way to really kind of see this is open up that Finder menu and let it sit open and then hold down the option key, you'll see that as you hold it down, the ellipses goes away from empty trash and secure empty trash. And what that means is it's just going to go. But there's one more thing that happens. It will blow through any files that if there was a file that was locked and it said it couldn't empty that, if it has the permissions to delete it, it will simply delete it. If it doesn't, it's not going to warn you. It's just going to leave it in the trash. So holding down the option key with these pesky files may indeed get them, may blow them away. So that's yet another thing to try is holding down the option key.
That is, you know, I think I've actually seen a warning message sometimes saying, you know, I can't delete this, but if you hold this key down, maybe I'll try a little harder.
That's nice. Right. Yep.
That's a good one.
All right. Should we do Chris or should we move on to Simon, John?
Let's see.
We're going to
Chris.
Simon. All right. We're doing Chris. You
do
said
Chris.
It. Okay. Here it is. I got to find the email. Here it is. Chris says, hi, guys. I'm having a problem with iPhone sync freezing up when the status reads syncing contacts in iTunes. I've searched around a bit and haven't been able to find a solution. I'm running iTunes 8 and iPhone OS 3.0. After a restart of both the iPhone and my MacBook Pro, sync will work, but only once. Subsequent syncs require another round of reboots. Any advice would be greatly appreciated. All right, John, I'll let you take this, and then I might have some ideas, too.
I'm going to take it a little bit. Now, I don't have it in front of me, unfortunately. I can't see this menu because I don't have a device plugged into either computer right now.
Okay.
But one place you want to look is in iTunes. When the device is mounted, you'll see it under the device tab, I guess. You click on it, and there'll be a number of tabs on the top. So in the case of an iPhone or an iPod, and there is a info tab, I believe. I'm going by my notes here. And there is a entry, sync address book contacts, which it sounds like that's what it's trying to do.
Right.
As a diagnostic step, I would uncheck that. Try again. If it still screws up, then you have... if it still screws up, well, if it doesn't, then your data is bogus. Then you got a problem with your data file. And then I'll suggest something maybe to help out with that. Now, the other thing is you want to make sure, and I noticed this, there's a bunch of other things in there, which you may want to make sure it's not trying to do these, but I haven't noticed these. I haven't looked in this section of iTunes in a while, Dave. They're constantly adding little, you know, all sorts of little, little
yes.
interesting features in addition to features to break pre-syncing, but we won't talk about that.
Right, that's right.
But they, yeah, they played some dirty pool too. Anyways, we'll talk about that later maybe. So, but there are some settings I saw, Yahoo address book and sync Google contacts. Make sure those aren't checked and that it's not sitting there getting all confused. But then I noticed an advanced section and there is a setting that says replace info on this iPod contacts. If all else fails, you may want to try that and just see if doing that replace operation will wipe the data and somehow get you in a good sync state again. So those are my few suggestions, not having run into this, but things you can try to determine whether the problem is on your iPod or the data file, or you just want to go for broke and just wipe it out and try to start again.
Okay. So I have a couple of ideas. One is, I think your last suggestion is probably the closest to getting this resolved once and for all. My
nuke
thought
and
is
pave.
That, yeah, because it gets close to that nuke and pave, right? If he reboots, you know, which involves quitting iTunes and then restarting the OS. So what happens when we quit iTunes? Well, when we quit iTunes, it saves out its own preferences. Maybe quitting iTunes and relaunching would solve his problem. We don't know. But we also know that as part of a reboot, some, not all, but some cache files are deleted and then recreated on the way back up. So there might be some cache file. Now, it might not be an iTunes cache file. It might be a Sync Services cache file, because that's really what's tapping in here, right? Is Sync Services is this underlying thing. It's this, you know, it's this behemoth. And there's some, I wish I could remember what it was, but there's some code in there where it says, you know, that thou shalt not ever touch anything inside the sync databases because you'll blow your world up. It's Apple put this in there. It's actually very, very funny, but very true that the sync store is this, you know, thing that you just don't ever want to get involved with. And it sounds like that might actually be corrupted here. So, you know, as far as you can nuke and pave this, the better. One thing to try would be to go into the sync preference pane, the mobile me preference pane, and then go to sync and then tell it to go and wipe out mobile me. Now, you know, wipe out your contacts on mobile me. If in fact you have mobile me, if you don't, then you've got to kind of get involved in this app that's part of developer tools called Sync Respector. You can also try using the iSync app that John mentioned before. And I'm going to pull it up here because I'm sort of thinking about this on the fly. I've dealt with a lot of sync issues over time, and there is something. If you open up the iSync app, and I believe iSync is in the applications utilities folder. Is that right?
Nope,
it's just in the applications. Okay. If you go in and go to that dialogue we were talking about before, where it says in the preferences, there is an advanced option that says reset sync history. This will blow away a lot of those cache and history files that iSync maintains. It will not delete your data, but it will force all future syncs or the next round of future syncs to kind of start from scratch as opposed to building on their previous incantations. And that might help. So I would, you know, try this. You could also try running a utility like Onyx and cleaning your caches. That might help as well. But I think, you know, the fact that a reboot, or at least a quit and relaunch of iTunes, the fact that a reboot makes things better once leads me to believe that there's something sort of buried deep in the system that's not happy. And this reset sync history thing could very well do it. Before you do any of this stuff, make a backup of your contacts, and those are going to live. And I would make a backup of your calendars too, because when you reset sync history, it all starts going away. But if you go into address book, and you go to export, file, export, you can do an address book archive and it will back that up for you. So those are my thoughts on the subject, John. That was actually a good one. I'm glad we didn't skip that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got some thoughts, Dave. And the one thought I have is, what if I was listening to this podcast and I wanted to get in touch with us?
Well, you'd light a fire and you'd start doing smoke signals. Now, there's a couple of different ways to... No, never mind. You'd call 206-666-GEEK, which John is...
4335. Or you can email us at feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Yeah, now those emails to feedback@macgeekgab.com are interesting because you certainly can send text, and we've read plenty of text tonight. But since iPhone OS 3.0 has come out, we've started to get a lot more comments, audio comments, that have been recorded with the Voice Memos app on the iPhone. Once you record a voice memo, you can email it right from there and type in feedback@macgeekgab.com, and it comes in. You can hear the quality on the show is much better than when, you know, somebody records over the phone. So, you know, if you've got the ability to do that with your iPhone or even iPod Touch, right? The new iPod Touches with the microphone,
sure.
That'll work.
If you have a microphone, yep. And you know, Dave, it sounds marvelous.
Oh, it sounds great. Yeah. Thanks, Fernando.
And how else? You know, there's a, you know, www.macgeekgab.com where you can, you know, get right to the webpage that shows you all of the episodes.
Yep.
You know, if you're into the Twitter thing, which I heard has jumped the shark. But anyways, if you're still on Twitter, I'm John Efron. Dave is Dave Hamilton. Pilot Pete is Pilot Pete. And of course, you can look at the official Mac Geek Gab feed at Mac Geek Gab and the Fountain of Knowledge, all Mac knowledge. Mac Observer also has a feed. And I don't know if there are any other TMO feeds.
I think there's Mac Observer Live that we use during keynotes and that sort of thing, but that's a dormant feed. So until it sparks up for a day.
Oh, well,
two.
Speaking of a little bit, yeah. Boy, did they just kick serious butt with their results.
Mm-hmm.
They are, all I noticed is that, you know, when Apple kicks butt and Microsoft is sucking wind, you know, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
They are just executing. You know, just
well, they're two different companies, right? I mean, Microsoft is very much a software company. Apple is more a hardware company and arguably becoming less of a computer company, right? I mean, they're in the cell phone business. So,
well, I think now, I mean, we saw this point a while ago, is that more than half the revenue comes from the, shall we call it, entertainment sector, which right. I would include the movies, the music, and the devices,
right.
iPod and iPhone. And then you got the computers, which still they sold a couple of million computers.
Yep.
But their income and their revenue. And yeah, you know, Microsoft, to me, the whole challenge is, other than I think Office and Windows, what do you got that's making money anyway?
Right. Well, they have Bing.
Yeah, but they're dealing with the 600 pound gorilla or the 6 ton gorilla or whatever you want to call it. Though I have had pretty favorable results. I will say Bing does not suck.
Oh, no, so. Bing doesn't suck. And I'm looking here to get today's results, but there have been many days where we get more traffic referred to TMO from Bing than we do from Google.
Wow.
Yeah, today it's, they're about neck and neck. But yeah, within a couple of percentage points. So people are definitely using Bing, even Mac users, or at least people interested in the Mac. So. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, you know, it's a good thing because Google's pretty good, but...
Yeah, they're not perfect.
I don't think anybody wants all their eggs in one basket.
Right. Right.
So, hey, where are we? So that was
kind of... You know where we are is we're now going to jump our own shark and talk about the same thing four shows in a row. And I'm gonna let Oscar's question lead us into the SSD realm again. But really, the reason we're leading ourselves here is because, John, you've actually took our discussions and you now have the physical manifestation of them.
I did it.
So let's let Oscar lead the charge here.
Hello, gentlemen. My name is Oscar Simmons. I'm stationed in Stuttgart, Germany. I have two follow-up questions to your last podcast regarding SSD and Express card slots. I did go ahead and pick up a 48 gigabyte WinTech off of the recommendation of one of your previous callers. And on one of the reviews of that drive, a customer mentioned being able to carbon clone his system and application folders over to the SSD to speed up the start and application launch times. My follow-up then is he mentions using a control click to be able to access his home directory on the spindle drive, but I'm not sure how that's accomplished. If you could provide any amplification, I would appreciate it. The second question is, when those files are moved over, does that also move over the virtual disk in case you run out of RAM? And as you were talking, the continuous reading and writing and defragmentation might harm the drive. Is there a method by which you could keep the virtual disk, virtual RAM, if you will, put back on the spindle to prevent long-term damage to the drive? Thanks for your time. Enjoy the podcast. You have a great day.
Okay, John, so let's, before we, let me pause Wes here. Before we dive into Wes's questions, why don't you talk about what you went ahead and purchased and how you're using it?
Great, because I don't think I can dive too deep, but we may. So anyways, what I got is, while you were away, you know, lounging about in the sun and the water and all that, is I got, you had challenged me. You're like, John, what are you doing with your express card slot in my machine? And I'm like, nothing. So I went online. I went to, I think it was Amazon, and I ordered a Sonnet. They call it a 21-in-1, though that's kind of pushing it. It's basically an express card to SD card memory reader.
Okay.
So now the thing you have to know, and so here is where, you know, I kind of geeked out. Express card does a number of things. So express card 34 specifically, because I think it's 34 millimeters wide, and there are a couple of different express cards. So the one on the Mac is express card 34. Here's the key. It can look like one of two interfaces for the most part, or I think entirely. USB 2.0, which is 480 megabits per second. Uh-oh. Yes.
Okay.
Or PCI Express, which is about a gigabit per second.
Ah.
Now, the device that I bought was a USB 2. Now, the nice thing about this is that it didn't require a driver. I just took one of my SD cards, a 16 gig card, class 4. I'm going to explain what that means because that gets to be a really gray area.
Okay.
And I tried to install OS X on it. It's a 16 gigabyte SDHC, which is high capacity, which I guess means 16 gigs is a lot. Though they're getting bigger. I'm not sure the limit. But anyways, to move on. So what I did is I plugged in the SD card, formatted it as a GUID, I think, that it insists that I do that. And then I installed OS X, and it installed. Because when you plug this in with the SD card, it's a USB drive. And of course, OS X, or at least, you know, on the latest hardware, you can boot from an OS X from a USB partition.
Right.
Or a USB drive. So I installed OS X. It took about an hour because this card, now this is a class 4 card that writes at about 15 megabytes a second. And it did maintain that throughput. But in the grand scheme of things, that is relatively slow. For memory. Now, what I did find is that if you look at the SD space or the CF, compact flash space, now my card does not do CF, but I have found Express Card 34 that do CF. Now, they have a weird way of rating these. So class 4 SD cards can go, basically a better way to measure it is a rating. And the rating that you have on cards is an X rating. So The fastest that I've seen for an SD card is a 300X card, and that's 45 megabytes per second.
Hmm.
So that's way faster than what I have now. What I have is a class 4, I believe it's a class 4 card, and it's kind of fuzzy. Between class 4 and class 6, the problem is those are not precise enough measures to measure the throughput. You really want to look at the X rating, okay, whether it be 100X. So a 100X card is 15 megabytes per second.
Okay.
300X is 45 megabytes per second. So you can get a sense for the relative speed of these. Now, a 300X card, they exist, but they're not very large right now. And they get to be, you know, pricey, not thousands, but maybe hundreds of dollars. What I want to get, so I tried a little test with a 16 gig card that was a class 4 card, about 15 megabytes per second. The problem is that's not quite large enough to hold OS X. Because after I installed and I tried to run a software update, I maybe had 3 gigs free and I tried to apply a software update that was about a gig.
Right.
But it said, oh, sorry, I don't have enough scratch space. I can't do this for you. So 16 gigs, at least for OS X levered, is too small. So I'm looking for a 32 gig card. Now, here's the problem. The fast cards are only maybe 8 or 16 gigs, at least the SD form factor, unless I look to CF. So you can see I'm having a funnel geeky time here because
why don't you just get rid of the card, get one of those 48 gig SSD drives that just goes in the express card slot and bypass this whole SD card fiasco that you got going
on. Because I'm on this path.
Okay. All right. That's going down this path. That's a fair answer. I like that. That's just good.
Because I'm learning. Right? No, I agree with you. I could get that. Of course, now I have a nice SD reader, The only problem with these readers is almost universally, unless one of our listeners knows, please let me know. The card juts out a bit. It does not plug all the way in. I've seen two different ones, the SanDisk and the Sonnet one.
Yep.
And based on what I've read, I think almost all of these are designed that way, which I got to imagine somebody, unless you just don't have the real estate, can make it so that you can stuff the SD card all the way in there. Because if this is in your travel bag, you may snap that sucker off.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah, that's
all I'm saying is that it's feasible. I installed OS X. I was able to boot. It was snappy for a 15 megabyte per second card. I want to get a higher speed and a higher capacity card. Now, of course, the other thing is you and I, Dave, to talk more about the space here, our friends at Crucial, who is known for making memory, and apparently they sent out a press release a couple of weeks ago, and they now have a 256 gig SSD with pretty reasonable, I think, in the 100 megabyte per second transfer for both read and write for $600.
240 meg per second read. And 215 meg per second writes, I think.
That's awesome. Based on the specs that I've seen of what's out in the field, that's
up there.
That's up there. And $600, that's a pretty competitive price point. Now, we've also
That's cheaper. And it's about as fast and cheaper, much cheaper than the Runcore. I think the Runcore is $900, right? It's $899 for the 256, whereas Crucial's is $600. So. Yeah,
so I'm sure
this is not just to be clear.
Leapfrog.
Just to be clear, I know we're kind of mixing messages here. The Crucial drive is not an express card drive. That is a hard drive replacement sized device.
Right.
So just to put that out there. But they're very Mac friendly over there at Crucial. They did not used to be years ago, but they've worked very hard, and they've even got, if you go to their page for SSD drives, and we'll put a link in the show notes, you pick what Mac you have, and it'll actually show you the options that fit for your Mac. And you put 15-inch MacBook Pro, 2.6 gigahertz, and it says, yep, okay, here's what you can take. So those prices aren't bad. And I think it was $349 for a 128, which isn't,
something like that.
Yeah, these prices are good.
And then one of our listeners, or a couple, have alerted us to the fact, because we were saying, how big can you get? And based on the latest information that we've received, I think OZC and another company, there are 1 terabyte SSDs, but you're probably going to be forking over $3,000.
Right.
But if you got the dough and you want a terabyte and an SSD that performs well,
that's crazy, man.
And let us know what it's like.
Yeah, let us know. Yeah.
Well, we're going to listen to this in 5 or 10 years and just chuckle because a terabyte will be like, a quarter or something.
All right, so let's wrap this up, and I'll answer Oscar's questions because I did a little research here while we were chatting.
Go,
so
brother.
Number one, how to change the location of the home directory. There's a Mac OS X hints article that talks to the, what appears to be a very Apple sanctioned way of doing this. There is a clear way of doing it. It involves going into, I believe you go into the network, system preferences into accounts and do it that way. But anyway, you've got it. It's out there. In fact, Dan Frakes submitted it also of the same IDG world over there. So that's number one. We'll put that procedure link out there. Number two is, how do we move the virtual memory swap file location? There is no Apple sanctioned way of doing this, but there is a way of doing it. And there's a hint or a tip over at Accelerate Your Mac that talks about, you have to edit the dynamic pager plist file and go change that. Yeah. It it looks worse than it is. It's a pretty straightforward change. You just go in and change one line and you should be good to go. So those questions should, or those answers should help you with your question there, Oscar. And I think that that kind of wraps this up there.
The band, they must have been sweating, dude.
No, they took five. Actually, they took 10. So.
It was, oh man, we were a little toasty here today.
It was
90s.
It was muggy.
I think we saw 90s.
Yeah, it was muggy today. It was gross.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we talked about how to find us. On October 11th, you can find me in person and at the PMUG meeting at Princeton, New Jersey. I will be giving a little presentation there on my Running Your Mac Lean, Clean, and Mean. And then we've got questions from the audience. And John, maybe we'll do a Skype hookup for some of that.
I'll call in. Know.
Maybe. Yeah. Let's figure it out. But that'll be fun. I'll do that on August 11th, which is a Tuesday night. So please do, if you're in the area, come down, say hi. And then I think afterwards there's... We're all going out for pizza or something. I don't know.
Wow. Are there any other events coming up, Dave?
There is. There's Blog World Expo, October 15th through 17th in Las Vegas, Nevada. You can get 20% off of your admission by using Observer VIP, OBSERVERVIP. You are a VIP to us. You're a VIP to them. So Observer VIP gets you 20% off. iPhoneAlley.com is where you can find everything else that Michael Johnston does when he's not busy, converting the podcast to AAC for you. Cashfly Hosting, they provide all the bandwidth to get this podcast right to your computer or iPhone or iPod or whatever it is. The podcast marketplace includes, of course, the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, PDF Pen from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Pathfinder 5 from Cocotech, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. You got anything else, John, before we wrap this one up?
I'm just glad to see you back, man.
It's good to be back. It was good to be away. You know, I'm very lucky because for me, a week of vacation actually feels longer than that. And I don't know why that is. I'm not really interested in figuring out why that is. Mm-hmm. But I get to like Wednesday of a vacation week and I think, wow, it's like I still got time to hang and chill out before I have to go back to work. And I was checking in a little bit. I had some stuff going on here that I couldn't completely detach from. Well, sometimes I get to detach completely. This was not one of those, but it was a great balance, actually. It worked out really well. So, as nice as it was to be away, it's great to be back. So, all right, that's it. We're out of here. Did you have a nice week off, John?
It was very relaxing.
Good. Thanks for subscribing, everybody, and don't get caught.
Made up.